Good evening. This is Crossroads. Let's stand on a street corner and watch the folks go by. Pick out this one or that one according to our fancy, and wonder where he's going and why, and say to ourselves, I'd like to know what sort of person that can be, and if perchance he's anything like me. Every street corner's a crossroad, and every week at this time, Jerry Belcher brings you a series of pictures, glimpses of passers-by. Real people whose appearance here is entirely unrehearsed. Tonight, Jerry stands at his mythical crossroad on the corner of Main and Whimsey Streets in that universal city of San Francisco. Come in, Jerry Belcher.
Thank you, Ben Morris. Hello, everyone. Join me here on this corner of ours. It's just like the corner of Main and Whimsey in your hometown. Join me here and let's pick out this one. The neat, competent-looking, middle-aged man. Let's tag along with him. He leads us into a section of the city not so far from the waterfront, where the air is heavy with the fragrance of roasting coffee. We follow him into his place of business and find him seated at a round table. And beside him, there's a king-size, polished brass cuspidor standing some 30 inches off the floor. This receptacle, we learn later, is a part of the business, and came to San Francisco those many years ago aboard a square-rigged coffee ship. Now, let's talk to our man. Mr. Gleason, you're a coffee buyer and a coffee taster, is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
And this matter of tasting coffee, which here is a very ceremonious thing almost, you don't call that coffee tasting. What do you call it?
Coffee cupping.
Cupping. And it's the process of selecting from a number of coffees the blend that you want. Is that the idea?
That is correct.
Why isn't that done just like somebody would do? Why can't you put out coffee like they'd make bread, for example? Couldn't you take a certain coffee from a certain plantation in, say, Central America, let's say, from coffee a certain known quantity from some other part of the world and put it together and make that the blend?
No, we can't do that. Some coffees have body, others have acidity, others have flavor. Some of them are perfectly neutral. We have to select the ones from various countries, put them together, and make the finished blend.
And they don't remain standard at any time, is that the idea?
No, that is correct. Sometimes at various seasons of the year from the same countries they will differ.
And every cup of coffee, then, that I get, day after day, year after year, has to go through this process of cupping.
Absolutely.
To make it what it is. That is the heart of the coffee business.
That is correct. In order to get uniform coffee, we have to keep this up constantly.
Well, now, just what is the actual process? You make the coffee. How do you make it? How much do you put in a cup?
Well, the exact measurement, I don't know, but the old rule in coffee is to take a dime and a nickel and three green coffee beans and have an exact same measurement of coffee.
The weight of coffee.
Same weight of coffee.
That's an old rule, is it?
That's correct.
And the weight you follow here follows that old rule?
The same.
You pour hot water on it and get ready, steep and ready for tasting. And then how do you go through the actual tasting? You have a spoon there, sure.
Well, maybe I'd better show you.
All right. Now, Emily Post wouldn't exactly approve of that. Why do you draw it into your mouth so sharply?
In order to get it over the palate to the taste buds.
Does one man do all the tasting?
At MJB, we have three people that do it. We don't rely on any one man.
That makes... they must agree. And when they do, then you've got your blend.
That is correct.
That blend's pretty carefully guarded, isn't it?
Very carefully.
No wonder you have so much ceremony around here concerning it. All right, sir, there's some pretty interesting things in the background of coffee, aren't there? Do you recall any of them?
Well, I recall the fable about the goats jumping about on a mountain, and the goat herder wondering what caused it, and followed his goats one morning and found them eating off a bush. He took the berries they were eating to a Mohammedan priest, and the priest made a brew of these berries, and coffee resulted.
Lo, there was coffee for the first time. What else? That's very interesting. What else?
Well, I believe somewhere around the 13th century, the Pope actually baptized coffee.
The Pope baptized coffee? For what reason?
Well, at that time, it was a Mohammedan drink, and in order to make it a good Christian drink, they had the Pope baptized.
Is that so?
Yes.
You're in a very interesting business, sir.
I believe so.
How long have you been at it?
25 years.
Just 25 years. And your taste improves day by day.
Well, I try to improve it day by day.
I don't know of any other man whose taste constantly betters itself after 25 years. I congratulate you, sir.
Thank you
very much for your time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Now back to our corner again to watch the folks go by. This time let's choose the fellow over there who isn't nearly so neat. You'd never take him for an eager beaver from the looks of him. Odd-looking devil. We find that he works in a nearby restaurant where he washes dishes and scrubs floors in return for his food. We try to strike up an acquaintance, and this is what we get.
Here's a gentleman I want to meet. May I have your name, please, sir?
Steve Smith.
Mr. Smith, where are you from?
Who, me? I don't know.
And at that, he's no different from any of the rest of us, except that he has his facts in simpler form, perhaps. Now, the corner of Main and Whimsey in San Francisco would not be complete without a cable car. So when one comes down our hill with its little bell jangling wildly, with everything and everybody giving it the right of way, with its conductor shouting to hold on tight for the curve, when that happens, let's get aboard. We feel like we were riding on one of those miniature trains they have in amusement parks. Two, this is the rush hour, and going up a hill with arms and legs waving out of it, our cable car looks for all the world like a caterpillar climbing a brick wall. But what do we care? It's a gay little car, so we ride it all the way out to the car barn and have a talk with our conductor. His name is Tony Campagna.
Tony, how long have you been working on a cable car?
Over 27 years.
Long enough to know better?
That's right.
I wouldn't be surprised. How long have these cars been in operation here in San Francisco, Tony?
Well, the California Street Line has been in operation since 1878.
Which means about 70 years?
Well, close to it.
Started about the same time horse-drawn cars?
Just about.
No electric power then?
No electric power then.
Operated by?
Horse cars and...
What operated the other cars, the cable cars?
The steam plant.
Steam, has that
Powered
been...
by steam.
They don't use any more at all?
No.
Now, these cars are pulled by an endless cable, Tony. We all know that runs under the surface of the street. You fellas, what are your duties in connection with handling that bus of yours?
Well, the conductor helps stop the cars when he's not collecting fares, but the gripman has to operate the grip. And as long as the gripman's got a hold of the cable, the conductor can put on all the brakes he's got, and it doesn't do any good. He just drags the car along. Uh-huh. But when the conductor's not collecting fares, then it's his duty to help stop the car at all times.
Who rings that bell so insistently on
this? Well, that's the gripman. When he gets mad at the machines in front of the car there, or the automobiles, and...
You collect the fares?
Yes, sir.
Do you always get them all?
Well, we try to.
Rush hour is pretty hard to do.
Well, it's pretty hard, but we do our best, and we get most of them.
How many passengers does a car seat, Tony?
Well, the cars are built to seat 34 people.
And how many have you known it to carry at one time?
Oh, about 142.
The fella, one hanging out of the fellow who's hanging out of the car, is that the idea?
That's right.
Jingle jangle down through Chinatown.
That's right.
You're kind of lucky to work on those things. In one sense, do you realize that? They're romantic little buses.
Yes, there's a lot of talk about doing away with these cable cars. I don't think they ever will in San Francisco.
I doubt it. How fast can you go on one?
Oh, about 9.5 miles an hour. That's the average speed.
That uphill or down, either?
It doesn't make a difference whether you're going up or down. The speed is 9.5 miles an hour, unless you let go of the cable, which is against the rules of the company to do so.
And which isn't done ordinarily if you value your neck, is
that right? That's right.
Is there no chance of their running away downhill?
Oh, no. We got safety devices on there to stop our car. We can stop the car within 30 feet or less.
How much weight does a man have to pull on that lever you've
well,
got there?
Well, I would say around sometimes about 150 pounds.
It looks to me like you'd have to be 40 feet across the chest to operate that thing, don't
you? Well, it does take a lot of muscles.
It's just simplicity that struck me. They have no brakes. Air brakes, have they?
No air brakes.
No motors?
No motors.
No trolley?
No trolley.
How do you get them in and out of the barn here?
Well, we have a turntable inside the barn that we have to get out and push the car around and get around on a table there, and then we just shove them out by
hand.
By hand,
in other words,
right.
A couple of men can push one
That's
around.
That's right.
Sort of push them up.
Two, three men to push the car out of the barn in the morning.
Well, they're good transportation, aren't they?
Oh, you bet your life.
And they're pleasant things to ride in, happy sort.
That's right.
Well, there's been, you mentioned a minute ago you didn't think they'd ever be done away with here in San Francisco. There's been a lot of agitation about that, hasn't there?
Well, there has been for quite some time, but I think the people of San Francisco won't do it with a cable car like they did the ferry boats and other things around here.
Too much a part of a very happy city. Is
that's
that,
right. That's correct.
The idea? Well, I hope they don't do away with them either, Tony, and may you long go clang-clang down
you.
That street of yours. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And back on our corner again, we can't help thinking that somehow the presence of these little cars helps to push aside the grimness that attaches itself to most large cities. Well, let's be on our way. This time, let's follow the little man there, the one with the gray hat and the gray look. He takes his way to a sukiyaki restaurant on the fringe of Chinatown, and there we find out more about him. Before the war, a fortune teller told this little man that he was going to make a long journey, and sure enough, he did. He went all the way to Utah and back. Now, this may not seem so long a trip from the standpoint of distance traveled, but the circumstances surrounding the journey must have made it seem a very long way indeed. The man's name is Ishizaki. Let's talk to him.
Mr. Ishizaki, your fare and all expenses on that Utah trip were paid for in advance, weren't they?
Yes, by the government.
By the government, just like any other trip to the jailhouse.
That's right.
How long were you there?
About 4 years.
4 years. What did you do during that time?
I was farming.
Farming? Yeah. You make any money at it?
No, just get by.
Nothing that you could spend, anyhow.
No, that's right.
Now, would you say that you enjoyed your stay? Well, you were in captivity anyhow,
that's
weren't
right.
you? You gave up your business here when you left, of course.
Yes.
Did you lose it entirely?
Yeah, entirely lost everything.
All now you're starting out all over again.
Yeah, that's right.
How old are you, Mr. Ishizaki?
54 years old.
How long have you been in this country?
Just over 30 years.
Did you rear your family here?
Yes, all the boys.
You had two sons. Where were they during the war?
Was in the army. Both of two sons, both of them in overseas.
One with Italy, was he?
One
with
was
the Japanese
yes,
troops there, Japanese-American troops there.
44 seconds.
That's all. So. You had a daughter, too. You have a daughter. Where was she during the war?
She was in the civil service. The translator at Tokyo, Japan.
You must be pretty proud of them, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Of course you are. How do you feel about the whole thing, Mr. Ishizaki?
Well, I should say the part of the life.
Part of life. I think that's a very fine way to look at it, sir. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes.
Now, what Ishizaki didn't mention was the fact that the boy who went to Italy was killed in action. Now, let's pause for just a moment on our corner and ask Ben Morris to take over while we pick out another customer. Will you, Ben?
Why, certainly, Jerry. A word for late tuners in. You are listening to a program called Crossroads. Most of us enjoy standing on a street corner and watching folks go by. We pick out this one or that one as being interesting looking and wish we might know more about him. It would be a pleasant thing to be able to follow some of them to their destinations. And that's what this program does. It brings you a series of candid pictures of folks you watch go by. Real folks from every walk of life. Each week at this time, Jerry Belcher stands at his mythical crossroad on the corner of Main and Whimsey Streets, somewhere, and watches the folks go by. Picks out this one or that one, follows him to his destination, and together we get the unrehearsed story. Our visits tonight are in San Francisco. We're ready to go again. All right, Jerry.
Right, let's be off. This time, we've chosen the most inconspicuous person around. He'd make a perfect plainclothes man, we think, because he'd never be likely to attract attention. He takes us rapidly up Market Street and into a building marked 1095. On the second floor, we pause before the door our man has just entered. And the sign on the glass reads, Warren K. Billings, Watchmaker. Shades of Tom Mooney. Can it be? Let's go in.
So you're Mr. Warren K. Billings, is that correct?
I am.
You the same Mr. Billings whose name was linked with Tom Mooney's for years and years while millions of people argued over your case?
Yes, I'm the same one.
You're the man. While they argued, you were doing time down in Folsom Prison, is that right, Mr. Billings?
That's right.
How much time did you do?
23 years.
23 years. That was all over a bombing which took place here in San Francisco. What year was that?
1916.
The occasion, Mr. Billings, was what?
The Preparedness Day Parade.
A lot of people remember. How old were you then?
23 years old.
when you were sentenced? 23 when you...
23, were that's right.
And your sentence was what, sir?
Life.
About the time the World War I, then you got your sentence?
Before the United States entered into World War I.
You weren't drafted then?
No.
Let's clear this one thing up for now. Were you a watchmaker at the time of the sentence, Mr. Belling?
No, I was a shoe cutter at that time.
Where did you learn watchmaking?
In Folsom Prison.
Now, how?
Well, I learned it the hard way.
How's that?
By trial and error method.
All right. Were you given all the tools you wanted to work with?
No, I made my own tools.
Is that so?
That's
sort
right.
Sort of worked in the underground, so to speak?
Yes, for the first 6 years, it was necessary for me to keep my tools hidden. So I was an underground watchmaker.
I suppose that there's a story in itself if we started talking about that underground, wouldn't there be?
Yes, it is. Quite a story.
I'm sure of it. All right, now, 23 years is a long time, and yet there doesn't seem to be any prison stamp about you whatsoever. How do you account for that, Mr. Billings?
Well, I didn't consider that I was doing time. I lived there just the same as other people live in the mountains or the deserts or anywhere else. I did what work was necessary, got what enjoyment I could out of life, and made the best of it.
You managed to keep cheerful.
I did.
There must have been hundreds of thousands of letters written you and Tom. Did you get any of them?
Oh, yes. Thousands of letters from all over the world. Great many of them written in Esperanto.
Is that so? When did you get out, sir?
October the 17th, 1939.
Tom was out about the same time?
No, he got out 10 months sooner, in January 1939.
Tom's dead now.
That's right. He died in 1942.
Your sentence was commuted, sir?
Commuted to time served, yes.
You're married now?
I am.
Were you married when you were sentenced?
No, I was married in 1940, in March.
That's so. Your marriage seems a very happy one, sir. If you don't mind my saying it, I'm sure it is.
It has been, and I'm sure it will continue to be.
You own your own home here, sir?
That's right, I do.
You work around the house any?
Oh, yes. I've been rebuilding the house and have it almost completed now.
Wonderful. All of which sounds very much like one of these lived happily ever after stories, but... Mr. Billings, I can't overlook those 23 very long years. What are chances for your pardon, sir?
Chances don't appear to be very good at the present time. I don't know definitely what is being done. The pardon has been hanging fire now more than 2 years.
Well, it would look like, on the surface at least, that a pardon would help you and hurt nobody else. I have power to you, sir. I hope you get it. Thank both of you for the privilege of coming up here, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Back at our crossroads again, we find so many fascinating passers-by that a choice is difficult. We're like a hungry man poising an anxious fork over a tempting, heavily laden smorgasbord. Let's take a chance on the huge old man with the sack on his back, the man with the seamy face that looks as though it had been carved out of old leather. Let's follow him out to his home on 45th Avenue and discover that his name is Lauricella, and that he drives an old Ford, which quite possibly has more rattles than any other car in the whole wide world, and that he runs up and down stairs as nimbly as a boy. And there he'll seat us in his best chair, and we'll get to know him better.
How old are you, Mr. Lauricella?
75.
75. 75 years young. You work every day, don't you?
Yes.
Where?
Flea market.
Farmer's market.
Farmer's market.
How many hours a day?
Oh, eight, nine.
Not ready for the glue factory yet, are you?
No, I should say not.
All right. How old were you when you came to this country?
I came in this country when I was 13 years old.
And how much did you weigh at the time?
150 pounds.
And you weigh now 200 and what?
220.
But you're getting along all right.
Oh,
you've grown a little in the last...
I say you have.
Well, tell me this, sir. You went to school then?
Yeah, I went to school one day only.
Why?
Because they put me in a baby class, and I was 150 pounds in baby class and looked so nice.
It didn't go so well. How'd you get your education? You said.
Well, I thought I play with a ball. I never play with a ball. I only play with a ball.
With a book?
With a book.
All
I found out that the word is in legs and knowledge in books. Any man that's dealing with a book, he certainly gets the knowledge out of it.
All right. You ever hear of that great Portuguese explorer, Marco Polo?
Oh, Not Portuguese.
No?
No, Italian. Venetian. Oh. Venetian gentleman.
Oh, I'm thinking of another man.
Apparently. Oh, he went to China 12th century.
Right you are.
And he made China so... he made Venice so rich that everybody used to go there rub them nighttime. And that's why they built Venice on the water. There's a reason for everything.
Why, of course. I was thinking of Vasco da Gama.
Yeah, now, that was a...
You like people, don't you?
Oh, do I? I've been dealing with them all my lifetime.
What do you think about them?
Why, people, the only way to deal with the people is to get acquainted with the people and adopt a good habit. Not the bad ones, but good habit.
Uh-huh. They remind you of anything in particular, people?
Well, more or less, you know, you find narrow mind, big mind, low mind, and slow mind.
Well, I think you told me that you thought they were a little bit like cucumbers, too, didn't you?
Oh, naturally. Anybody don't study life, they represent a cucumber. A lot of seeds are no sense.
That's all right.
Oh, easy.
You think there's any reason why a man shouldn't be a rich man?
Well, I tell you why. If everybody become rich, wouldn't be nothing doing.
So it's all right to have one rich and one poor?
Oh, sure. 90 rich, poor and 10 rich.
Mm-hmm.
I know a riddle that say you want to stop and debate the courts of a common rich and great. There isn't such a thing inside the gate. Honest to show such showing the whole world entitled to. Successful, don't we?
Let's leave him there in his comfortable parlor with a more than faint suspicion that neither you nor I will ever reach so vital a 75 as has Mr. Lorigella. Now we're ready to choose another passerby, our last visit for tonight. We might go along with that red-faced panhandler, except that we already know where the trail would end. He would lead us eventually to his midnight misery on Howard Street, where he will sit with his back against a wall beside a legless beggar. And together they will watch helplessly and silently as their bottle rolls across the sidewalk and crashes into the gutter. Now, let's find a happier picture. The tall, dark-haired, slender man, the one with the worried look, he'll do. With him, we'll wend our way to St. Mary's Hospital. And there, up on the third floor, we'll move along a quiet corridor marked maternity. And at the end of this hallway, we'll come into a cheerful room where there are deep leather chairs. Here a man may rest, if he can.
You're Mr. Ferranti. That's right. And you're an expectant father. That's right. How long have you been waiting here in the hospital?
Well, it is 1 o'clock this morning.
How many years is that?
Well, the first one of 5 years.
About 5 years. How far have you walked?
Oh, upstairs and down, from down, upstairs and downstairs, up again.
The mileage has gotten longer and longer.
That's right.
Is this the first one?
The first one.
That doesn't make it any easier for you, does it?
Oh, no.
Well, tell me something, if you will, Mr. Ferranti, that will help. We've often wondered why it is that most of us try to make a comedian out of a fellow in your place, and actually, there isn't anything funny about it, is there?
That's right. Nothing funny about it. It's only when you're smoking.
That's all there is to it?
That's all there is to it.
Well, why is it that we're inclined to laugh at people in your position?
Well, it's not an opinion of people.
Seriously, I wonder if you've had the reaction that most of us expect that fathers have had and haven't said anything about it. Has it occurred to you at all that you're a part of a miracle, that maybe there's something somewhere bigger than some of us?
Yes.
That comes first, huh?
That's right.
Make us all feel that way. Then they can laugh at us all they want to about that, too.
That's right.
You've had a lot of good wishes from your friends, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, very good.
What are some of those good wishes?
Well, some wish they had a boy, some wish they had a girl.
Has anybody thought of the good wish to wish you just good luck?
That's right, a lot of them did.
Well, I'm sure the listener will agree with me in wishing you that one thing, the best wish we could get for you at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good luck.
Thank you
very much for your interview, sir.
Okay, thank you.
So life goes on at the crossroads of San Francisco, even as time has moved on with us here. There are those of you who will remember when this program began. We're all older now. As you walk down the street tomorrow and catch yourself making little mental notes of the people you pass, remember this program. This is Crossroads. Join us next week, won't you? On the corner of Main and Whimsy Streets, somewhere. Until then, this is Jerry Belter saying good night, and thank you for listening. Come in, Ben Morris.
Yes, this is Crossroads, with its simple, informal dignity. It's in capable hands. The program moves rapidly, yet remains a coherent unit. It's extremely flexible, capable of touching any subject, anytime, anywhere. It can be produced well in advance of showing, thus insuring against duds, illness, or accident. Its content can be selected, cut, or deleted, thus making it a controllable, scriptless show. It has tremendous range, both in travel and within the framework of the individual program. It is comparatively inexpensive, requiring only one man for a cast and for travel. No giveaways are employed. It is highly merchandisable. There is no other program like this. This is Crossroads.